Most of you know John Patrick, but for those of you that may have forgotten some of his background, he's a British-trained physician. He's done extensive research into the treatment of childhood nutritional deficiencies and related diseases. He's held appointments in universities in Britain, the West Indies, and in Canada, where he retired as the associate professor in clinical nutrition at the University of Ottawa. He's also done projects in Central Africa in training programs dealing with childhood protein energy malnourishment. But most of you know him as an apologist, someone who can explain Christianity to others and to us who are Christians in ways we've not heard it before. I know he's impacted my life. I know he's impacted many of yours. Just recently, I had the opportunity to sit down with him. And in the midst of that conversation, I turned to John and said, John, tell me what you've been thinking about. What's God been teaching you? And here's how the conversation went.
There's been one really quite interesting phenomenon for me, which sort of crept up on me without me being aware of what was happening. I was in BC, in Vancouver, a few months ago, basically to do part of a course on the official schedule with the university, which included distance education on other campuses. But somebody who follows me in some way noted I would be in Vancouver, and I got this call saying, we're running an apologetics conference in Chilliwack, which is up at the top of the Fraser Valley, just before you get to the mountains. And he said, would you come? And I said, sure, I can do that. What do you want me to do? He said, well, we have nobody to help young Christians talk about the issues related to medicine that they get into trouble with at school. I said, oh, that's no problem. I can do that. And I didn't think anything about it. I didn't ask him how big it was going to be or who was going to be there. I was a bit flippant, really, I suppose. But when I got there, I think it was approaching 1,500 people.
Wow.
And they'd come from as far away as Montana. That was a bit surprising. I mean, some of the other speakers were very well known, but I was totally unprepared for this. And, of course, I was an unknown quantity since I spent most of my time with doctors. But there was a real intense interest over, I suppose it was 3 days. And then shortly after that happened, I got a call from a Baptist guy in Campbell River who said, I was at the conference in Chilliwack. We're running a similar one, and I see you're going to be in Edmonton anyway. Could we tag on to that and have you come to us as well? So I did that. And then during the summer, I had my first experience of being involved with Ravi Zacharias, and they had an apologetics conference in Hamilton for Christians who want to learn to argue the case, and I was stunned. There's something happening.
Wow.
And of course, part of it, we see our own students when we send them off to university, really turning the pressure up on the secular environment. A lovely example, this academic year, one of last year's grads, starting a year in pre-med. And about 6 weeks into the course, a professor teaching the biopsychosocial aspects of medicine began his lecture with the first overhead saying there are no absolutes. And Nathan immediately raised his hand, which, as you well know, doesn't normally happen in first-year university. The guy looked up and said, yes, what's your problem? And he said, sir, is that sentence internally consistent? And there were enough people, as quick as you, in the audience amongst the students who started laughing. Some of them, of course, didn't understand what was going on. But the guy himself was both smart and sensible. He realized he was thoroughly beaten, so he did the only thing you can do. He climbed down graciously. He said, I suppose I should say thank you. It is a foolish sentence. I must remove it. Thank you. But, of course, that led to lots of conversation. But he thought, I'm bound to get hammered for it in Marx at some point. There will be revenge, which would normally be the case, but there wasn't in this case. In this particular course, they do quite a lot of small group stuff, and they have to do a joint presentation in pairs to show that they can work together and make a presentation and include one another, you know, that sort of thing. And after this episode, a Muslim girl came up to Nathan and said, she'd been in this small group. She said, I like the way you treat women, and I like how smart you are. Will you do your presentation with me on some aspect of sexuality?
Hmm.
And he said, yes. What about Reichardt's bitter pill? I don't know if you know that paper.
Mm-mm.
It's the first economic analysis of the effect of the pill. that I know of. It's a stunning paper. It's an academic paper, but the point can easily be made. Basically, Reichardt argues that the net effect of the pill has been to transfer money from women and children to men. And he's got the data to prove it. So they talked about what the pill had done, both economically and why it had worked, which is, we can talk about that if you want to in a moment. But when they got to give their presentation, who was the invigilator but the guy that he had previously taken down? And he said to the Muslim girl, we're not going to get good marks, you know. But the guy actually gave them maximum marks. He said, first of all, for courage on taking that subject on, and secondly, because you did it excellently. So there's something going on when, you know, Muslim girls come and ask Christian boys to present on sexuality, when not 10 or 20, but over 1,000 turn up to an apologetics conference, and it's sold out, both the Chilliwack one and the Ravi Zacharias one. They were turning people away. So I'm thinking a lot more about churches and how we... I don't think we've done as good a job interacting with churches as we should. I mean, people like Joe McElhane have provided the material, but I haven't done a good job. I'm sure you've done better than me, but I think we could do a lot more.
Yeah, I think so too, and I think they need that. I mean, because often, though they have great biblical training, they don't know how to apply it into the medical, bioethical, social issues that we deal with in medicine.
Have tended to be too nice.
Yeah. What else is going on? I mean, what else you've been thinking about, reading about? We always learn from what you've been learning.
It's always books. I can't remember when I last talked to you on Doctor's Digest.
Probably been over a year ago.
Well, I'm not sure when I picked up James Calve's book, The Tyranny of Liberalism. Is it a new title to you?
It is.
Yeah. Okay, then I probably didn't do it last time. I don't know a great deal about the man who wrote it. He's a lawyer in New York, but he's written a very, very interesting book, basically elaborating on some of the things that I do, but putting them in a broader perspective and doing it very well. You can watch at the moment in your politics how people whose hearts are in the right place get hammered in the public square,
mm-hmm.
largely because they don't understand what the nature of the argument is, and so they're easy to portray as ignorant, whereas in actual fact they're not. But they are a little lazy in dealing with the basic issues. The subtitle of the book says most of what it's about. It says, Understanding and Overcoming Administered Freedom, Inquisitorial Tolerance, and Equality by Command.
Wow. It's a mouthful.
It is, but that is what the liberal elite take as given. And we don't attack them on those points, which are, in fact, very attackable. And so we lose because they've controlled the thought patterns of society now the process goes back to the Enlightenment. It's three centuries or more. So that students are frightened to say, I am intolerant. Whereas if they stop to think for a moment, they could realize that Ten Commandments are 10 things that God will not tolerate, or at least you could rewrite them in that form, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
And it is that framework of what we will not do that actually provides for the freedom that our society used to have. But because we no longer have that base, now we have to have bureaucrats telling us we are to be free in this way, but we cannot be free in that way. They don't look upon freedom as we do, freedom to be what we ought to be. In the wonderful Anglican prayer book phrase, whose service is perfect freedom. I mean, that's a paradox, isn't it? But you and I know that it's true. It is only when we truly submit to the Lord's ways that we are truly free in ourselves to be what we know deep down we ought to be. And so I think this book would be any of your guys that you're sending out to take on the liberal elite would do well to read it. It would give them some insight into what we're dealing with and why we so often lose. They define freedom as lack of interference. We define it in an entirely different way. They look upon tolerance as a primary virtue. We ought to look upon it as an administrative technique, which is what they do. The best book on that is A.J. Conyers' book on tolerance, a prof at Baylor. He's dead now, but he wrote a superb book giving you the history of how it all came about, which is very useful when you're arguing with somebody who claims to be well-educated.
Mm-hmm. So what are the main points on how you deal with them? I mean, if you had 10 minutes to tell somebody how to deal with what they're seeing in the public square and hearing in the public square, based on this book and your own knowledge, what would you say?
Well, the first thing is ask questions, don't make statements as far as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, say, take abortion. You know my approach, but it's a good example. Don't go for abortion. Go for the idea, what would you need to believe to be an ethical abortionist? What are you saying about the meaning of human life and therefore about the meaning of your own life when you espouse this way of solving a problem? And, of course, the only way they can get out of that is by saying, well, we live once and that's it. Life has no eternal meaning. And then you can say, well, what if you're wrong and it does? And, of course, in the history of the world, most people have thought there's more to it than meets the eye. From the Greeks all the way through, it's only in the last 300 years or so that we've tried behaving as though that is not true. And look at the mess we're in. So that's number one. Ask questions and get them to think about what they're taking for granted. They expect when they say you are intolerant that you will fold up and say, I'm very sorry. And I say, well, that's an interesting statement. There are things I'm intolerant of, but presumably you're not tolerant of child abuse, so you're intolerant too. So should we not discuss when it's appropriate and when it's not, rather than this sort of blanket, politically correct, everybody must be tolerant? The things we ought not to tolerate, it's not good for the people who are doing it, and it's not good for us, and it's not good for society. What I'm saying, of course, is that if we're going to do a decent job, we've got to do a bit more reading so that we can talk about our understandings of freedom and justice and tolerance and how they have put equality as the objective of every exercise. Whereas the Bible is very clear. We're all different. We're equal in God's sight as his creatures, but he has made us for different purposes. And where those purposes are concerned, he has equipped some for one thing and some for another. We all have a role. But to say that we're all equally stupid, it's clearly untrue. We're different. Now, we have duties that we should all obey. Ultimately, for the Christian, it is whatever our abilities, they are should be at the service of our brother and sister. Love is what we call it. But I still, sadly, when in my travels, meet people who've never made their way through Lewis's basic works, and have not met Peter Kraft, have not read any Leslie Newbegin. The people who can really help you to understand what the university does to you. I mean, we know, we do this in the eight-month program at Augustine, and the kids who take that course, they flourish in university, and they can take their profs on, like Nathan did. He's not alone. Interestingly, we've had a fully-fledged doctor take the course for the last 2 years.
Hmm.
One from Norway that I met in Uruguay at the ICMDA meeting, Lisa Gilbert, who's an American, who's taking 8 months off to do our course because she says, I want to do mission work and I think I need it.
Uh-huh.
And it's a joy to watch what happens as they meet all sorts of people who said and thought things centuries ago that they know nothing about and they wish they did.
How's Augustine doing? I know I meet more and more people who've either been there, want to be there, or are going to be there.
We're not getting enough people, though.
Huh. Well, if people want information, what do they need to do?
Well, it's very countercultural. So you're asking them to do something which requires courage. And that we do get extremely interesting students. One of them this year is a medical student from Arizona who she just felt that the medical school course was missing something. And she went searching through the web and found us on the web.
Wow.
And there she is. A Christian who was really rather lonely and is delighted to have found somewhere where she can get some sustenance. But we've had parents who've been to us, and they've tried bribery and corruption even to get their children to come. But many of them are they're like you, a straight arrow. You went through medical school with the objective of getting to the mission field as fast as possible.
Right.
Now, looking back, God knows what he's doing. But there would have been some benefit to you having a bit more liberal education before you went.
Absolutely. And even more so ended up the fact of where I ended up.
Yes.
You know, there's one thing to be in the hinterlands of Kenya dealing with tribal groups versus, you know, on the public platforms we have now. But I think it serves people well wherever they go, and especially into as missionaries as they're trying to penetrate into Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim areas. It's just essential.
I had a lovely time when I went to Tenwick this year.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You didn't know I'd been to Tenwick?
No.
Oh, yeah.
You found me still wandering around there, in at least spirit.
Oh, your ghost was everywhere, yes. But the really interesting thing was, the reason I went is that Dr. White sent his son Adam to us the year before.
Oh, wow.
And he wanted me to go anyway, so Sally and I went. We had a lovely time, and we also spoke to a missionary retreat at Mombasa afterwards. Mm-hmm. And that, the whole thing was a delight. But as you say, what brought it to mind is there's so many things that missionaries always say the same thing. Why didn't I learn that before?
Right.
I mean, how many missionaries of the evangelical persuasion have ever been sat down and said, okay, you know about how people come to Christ, or more precisely, how Christ comes to people. But what comes next? Why were the epistles written? Does conversion make you good? And of course the answer is no. So what does the Bible have to say about how people are going to be not only brought into relationship with Christ, but able to become his ambassadors to the world to make it a better place? Now, that Christianity has made the world a better place can easily be done. The historical data is overwhelming. And yet I find Christians who are taken in by Dawkins. Mm. I don't understand that. David Hart's Atheist Delusions just takes him to pieces. But then you read John Lennox and people like that, and he takes him to pieces. Yet so many Christians are basically reading the New York bestsellers list. That's stupid, with respect.
I agree with you, and it's so easy, especially when you have all the academic requirements of continuing ed and keeping up with the journals, keeping the specialties, then you're reluctant to take something serious on in a field that's just as, if not more important than what you're doing medically. Obviously, we need to be competent, but at the same point,
yeah,
we need to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ, and if we put half as much training into that as we put into our profession, where would we be?
Exactly. I mean, when I look back on my own career, I wandered in the wilderness for 20 years because of a failure in this direction.
Yeah.
And when I list my six things your children must be able to deal with before they go to university, parents invariably say, please go through that again slowly so I can write them all down.
Mm-hmm.
But most years, by the time the students have finished my course, I get them to write an essay on reductionism. Some of the essays I've got are absolutely stunning. And every year, one of them points out an example of reductionism that I'd missed entirely. And this year was really very funny because one of the students pointed out that one of my own interests, nutrition, is reductionism. Because what God made was food. What we talk about is nutrition. And actually, if you get food right, you get nutrition right, because God knew how to make food.
Right.
But you go into evangelical homes in North America and snoop in the kitchen cupboards, and there's hundreds of dollars worth of supplements.
Mm-hmm.
What's that saying about food?
Yep.
And about God's ability to make it? No one in my family has ever taken a supplement.
And our discipline to eat it, as we should.
Yeah, you eat good food, you don't need it. We do have one in Canada, in that the milk is fortified with vitamin D. But that's because, as Trudeau said, really Canadians ought to be in the Caribbean for a month every winter.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would argue with you with that. That would solve that problem.
Yeah.
Well, John, it's been great to talk to you. Always stimulate our thinking. You always give us great resources. You always make us want more. And that's good. We never get enough. And I want to thank you for for your dedication over, I don't know, how many years has it been? It's been almost as long as I've been at CMDA.
It was somewhere in the late 80s or early 90s.
Yeah, 90s. Because when I came on to CMDA, somebody handed me your Myth of Moral Neutrality tape. I was traveling, driving up Midwest somewhere, and I listened to it three times and called you after that. And that's how this whole thing began.
Yeah.
You were doing some speaking then, but it kind of blew up when that happened. And you have not, your life has not been the same since.
That's an understatement, yes.
Yeah. But you were faithful to answer that call and to meet the need and minister to us.
You know, faithful hardly comes into it, does it? It's such a pleasure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pure grace in our lives. God could do it all without us, but he lets us do these things. And you've really made a lot of these things possible. The college would not have survived if it hadn't been for the contact you've given me with American doctors. There's no question that that was absolutely essential to survival.
John, thanks again for being with us and all that you've done for the kingdom.
It's been a pleasure, as it always is, and it's nice to be able to point out that American physicians have made most of this possible for me, and they have certainly been absolutely critical supporters of Augustine College, which is, I urge them to send us some more students, that's all.
Yeah.
But God bless you.
God bless you. I know you love John Patrick as much as I do. And, you know, the thing with John, you can listen to him again and again because it's just almost impossible to internalize everything he says from just one or even two hearings. And we've got a lot of great resources of John. One of the ones that I really appreciate the most because it was the first one I ever heard him, and that was The Myth of Moral Neutrality. It's in one of our Just Add Water videos, and it goes on with another presentation on much more than a baby dies in abortion. If you want to hear an articulate presentation on abortion that would just click with a secular audience, that was one you need to get. And then for those of you that are hardcore, we have The Best of John Patrick, Volume 1 and Volume 2. These are 6 or 8 CDs in each volume with multiple talks from John. Man, if you've got a long trip, this is what you need. You'll be traveling along with your intellect stimulated and your thought process going, and the miles will go by. Those are available through Life and Health Resources. You can go to cmda.org and get them, or give us a call. It's toll free at 888-230-2637.